Welcome to St. Louis on the Air and our legal roundtable discussion. The recent election may have decided some important issues, but also left some big questions in its wake. We'll talk about them. We'll also look at a decision Missouri voters may be making in the future, whether to outlaw discrimination based on sexual identity or gender. And the Missouri Supreme Court gives a final answer to questions some St. Louis firefighters have had about where they can live. I'm Don Marsh. With me in studio are attorneys Mark Smith, Assistant Vice Chancellor at Washington University. He directs the Career Center there. Bill Freivogel directs the SIU Journalism School in Carbondale. And joining us for the first time, Tom Keefe, named earlier this year as the interim dean of the St. Louis University School of Law for the current academic year. Thank you all so much for being with us. And Dean Keefe, thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here, Don. Thank you.
Well, let's start right at the beginning here because we have a lot of ground to cover today. Bill, I'll start with you with regard to the Missouri Supreme Court ruling on firefighters. This is a big deal, obviously, for firefighters.
Yes. The Missouri Supreme Court upheld a 2010 law that permits veteran firefighters in an unaccredited school district to live outside the district. And, of course, this affects St. Louis firefighters because the district there was unaccredited and now is provisionally accredited. The law also affects school districts provisionally accredited. The court, it was Judge Stith who wrote the opinion for the Missouri Supreme Court. And she said that that the legislation which Jim Lebke had gotten passed in the legislature was not what's referred to as a special legislation targeted at one particular area. Secondly, they said that it did not violate St. Louis's city charter home rule powers. Under the city charter, St. Louis can set the employee's powers, duties and compensation, but the court said that a residency requirement was not a power, duty, or compensation. And so it wasn't included under St. Louis's home rule powers. And then finally, the court said that it was a rational piece of legislation that would the legislature could easily say that it was to help students get better educational attainment and keep firefighters in the city of St. Louis so they didn't move away to get their kids better education.
I think this is the question a lot of people had, is how school accreditation worked its way into the firefighter residency mix.
Well, I think it was probably a way in which former Senator Lemke could accomplish his aim. That was one of the reasons that the city argued that it was special legislation targeted at the city. But Missouri Supreme Court said was that it did that the classification of a city with a residency requirement and an unaccredited school district was one that other cities could end up in the same category, so it didn't just necessarily affect St. Louis.
So
it had
this
open boundaries.
Is this likely to be the end of it?
I guess for the time being. Mm-hmm. At some point, maybe St. Louis will get back an accredited full accreditation, and then I don't know where we go from there.
Yeah. There are two other issues relating to the Missouri Supreme Court I just want to throw out there. We don't have to prolong discussion, but it is set to hear a challenge this week to Paul McKee's plan for developing a large portion of the north side of St. Louis. This involves the tax increment financing.
Right, and this a couple of years ago, Judge Durker ruled that the McKee plan didn't have enough specifics to it, and the Court of Appeals later upheld that, said they generally agreed with Durker, and now this goes before the Missouri Supreme Court to see if they do as well. And there's a nice piece by Tim Logan in this morning's St. Louis Post-Dispatch discussing how this could or might not affect large redevelopment districts such as, say, Grand Center, Lafayette Square, those kinds of projects.
And the Supreme Court has also given a boost to the bargaining rights of public employees in the state of Missouri.
Right. They ruled, I think, with one dissent that public bodies have to negotiate in good faith with public unions.
Why is that stipulation necessary? Folks might wonder, if all negotiations aren't done in good faith.
Well, I just say there was the argument made by some districts. I think in this case, one of them involved the construction, construction charter plan in charter school in the city of St. Louis. And there was the argument that, well, just because teachers have a right to collective bargaining, that doesn't force us to talk to them. They can have a right to collective bargaining without us negotiating with them in good faith. Mm-hmm. And the Supreme Court said the right to have a union implies the right of good faith discussions.
Well, the Supreme Court's Missouri Supreme Court has been a busy place recently and will continue to be. Mark, let me turn to you because mm-hmm. one of the issues their justices may have to deal with in the future could involve the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender community, because that might someday go before the voters.
Right, right. So there was, we had in 2004, Missouri voted on an initiative to ban same-sex marriage, and that passed. I think something like 70% voted for it. There's been an initiative recently to outlaw discrimination based on sexual orientation. We also have the United States Supreme Court looking like it may hear an issue related to whether the Defense of Marriage Act, that's a federal law, might violate the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution. So a lot of this stuff is in play now. And what I find really interesting about it is, and we've talked about this a little bit in the past, one of the areas that the law sometimes has problems with is when you have social norms changing. I think the way society views gays has changed dramatically over the last 30, 40 years. And so you've got courts thinking one way a long time ago, and now maybe thinking a different way. And so you've got this kind of this philosophical question. Should the courts just come in and rule, or should we let voters do it? We've had these initiatives, I think, what was it, three or four states where they
struck down
bans on gay marriage or didn't pass a ban on gay marriage. And in 2004, there were a bunch of initiatives to outlaw it, and they all passed. So I think you're seeing particularly young people's opinions change. And so I wouldn't be surprised at all if the Supreme Court took up this case and said they're going to strike it down.
Well, apparently it's going to decide on Friday, whether or not to deal with Proposition 8. Mm-hmm. Anything to add to that, Dean Keefe?
Well, I would say, first off, just call me Tom.
All right, Tom.
You know, this Dean thing has really been kind of an interesting thing. I'm starting to get schizoid. I think my name is Tom. It's interesting. One of the things that I find very interesting about the gay and lesbian issue as it relates to the court is that there are a number of legal scholars in the gay and lesbian community who hope that the court does not take this case. And that it's not so much that they hope that they don't take it because they're concerned about whether they can get five mm-hmm. votes or four votes. But there's a feeling that sometimes if the court gets too out in front of what the popular opinion is in the community, is that they can cause more damage to
right.
that movement. You know, the 1964 Brown versus Board of Education, it was years before the states actually started to enforce that law. So it really is kind of a split decision. And I think there's a lot of people who might wish that Supreme Court, backs off, doesn't take the case, and then allows public opinion to start taking
change.
Its own – yeah,
take
its own
And course. that a vote of the people is seen as much more legitimate and much more kind of affirming. And you have the whole what's the abortion case? Why can't
Roe
I
– yeah, right.
Where the court got out so far ahead and you've had all this pushback. And it undermines kind of the legitimacy of the court, too.
Influenced at the time, by the way, by the whole Equal Rights Amendment fight and the women's issues that were in the mm-hmm. forefront at that particular time.
Well, I don't think there's much question about that. But there are a lot of people who believe that the Republican Party, deep down, would never want the Supreme Court to ever overturn Roe versus Wade. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's just such a false issue. When people talk about the litmus test for Republican justices is that Roe versus Wade. Will you overturn Roe versus Wade? Roe versus Wade has kept the Catholic, the Catholic Church on the Republican side. I mean, Roe versus Wade has been a tremendous source of funding for Republican parties. I really question politically whether or not Roberts and/or Alito, deep down, care very much about Roe versus Wade and whether or not they, in fact, prefer to keep it in play because it's a great source of fundraising for the Republican Party.
One thing about these cases that the court is going to be talking about in their private conference on Friday and then possibly as early as Monday announcing whether they're going to hear is that they don't necessarily have to deal head-on with whether gay marriage is whether bans on gay marriage are unconstitutional, because one of the cases involves the Prop 8, which is a sort of a different kind of issue, whether or not voters can pass such a piece of legislation, and whether or not once they have a court can throw it out. And then there's the others are the DOMA law, the Defense of Marriage Act, mm-hmm. Whether or not gay marriages or gay partnerships can be discriminated against. And so even if they were to say the federal law is unconstitutional, that doesn't mean that everybody has to permit gay marriage. Mm-hmm.
Anybody else want to weigh in on this part of the conversation? Tom, let me come back to you then. As you well know, you work on this side of the river, at least part-time, in your interim job at St. Louis University. But your shingle is out in Belleville, correct?
That's correct.
But you're aware that Amendment 3 passed here in the most recent election in Missouri, basically on the way that maintaining the nonpartisan court plan that we have here. It was a very convincing win. How do you read that from your position as an attorney in Belleville and Illinois, where judges are selected quite differently?
Well, I'm going to start off by saying this, is that I'm a card-carrying member of the Democratic Party in Illinois, and I'm proud of that. But at the same time, I'm going to tell you something. I am in favor of anything that allows me to save money on political contributions. And I'm not just talking about me. I'm just talking about anything that will take money out of the political system, I'm in favor of. And so I was very pleased with the outcome in the Missouri race, because I think that if the Missouri plan – and I don't know how many people really understand what the Missouri plan is. But, I mean, the Missouri plan basically provides that all judges for the appellate court is that three lawyers are elected by the Missouri bar. And then in addition to that is that three citizens are selected by the governor, but it's important to note that they're staggered for every 2 years. And then, of course, the Chief Justice of the court sits on the panel as well and is the tie-breaking vote. Well, the reality is that what they were now talking about doing is that they would have politicized it a good deal more. And they would have politicized it a lot more, because under this new plan, what would have happened was is that the governor would have picked all four people and they could have all been lawyers. And so at that point, then, you're going to start to concentrate this into the hands of the governor. Right. So really, I mean, I was happy to see that the Missouri plan had maintained itself. In Illinois, we spend a tremendous amount of money on judicial elections. And the poster boy for it, of course, was the 2004 race with Justice Carmeier, now sitting Justice Carmeier, and Gordon Megg. $10 million. Can you imagine that? $10 million bucks.
Well, this may not be over. Jim Lemke was a senator whose name came up a little bit earlier in the program, was a guest on this program a week or two ago after the election, and he predicted that our state legislature here in Missouri is going to pass legislation providing for the election of appellate judges in this state. That's what you've got going in Illinois, and that's where big money can reside.
Well, and that's where I think the thing folds into Citizens United. See, Roberts is an awfully smart guy, Chief Justice Roberts. And one of the things he did in the Affordable Health Care Act, of course, is that he kicked the Medicare, Medicaid things back to the states. There was a fair amount of money spent on state Supreme Court races and appellate court races this year. Not as much as in the past, but a lot. I mean, $30, $40 million, $50 million. If we're going to continue to elect judges, and you're going to then have what I perceive to be the pernicious influence of Citizens United, then at that stage of the game, you're really trying to inject money into the judiciary. And I think that any effort by Senator Lemke, of course, many of Senator Lemke's, although Senator Lemke did design my coats and ties because he used to sell coats and ties.
He may be going back to that because he's not going back to the legislature.
He was very good at coats and ties. But any efforts like that I mean, who would be interested in that? I would assume it would be the people who have money to spend.
Yeah. Got to take a break here. Let's do that now. We'll come back and continue our conversation. This is Legal Roundtable Day. You've just been hearing from Tom Keefe, the interim dean at St. Louis University School of Law. Also with me in studio is Bill Freivogel and Mark Smith, regulars for this panel that we have once a month, this Legal Roundtable panel. Come back to continue the discussion. I want to continue with Citizens United when we do come back. Meantime, this is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And hello again. Welcome back to our Legal Roundtable discussion today. Mark Smith with us, Assistant Vice Chancellor at Washington University. Bill Freivogel directs the SIU Journalism School in Carbondale. And Tom Keefe is with us. He is the Interim Dean at St. Louis University School of Law. Just another moment or two on Citizens United. You know, an awful lot of money was spent by various PACs and individuals during this most recent campaign, and very little. It produced very little in the way of results, the results that people wanted. I wonder, Bill Freivogel, I know you follow this very closely, does this presage, do you think, the possibility of some sort of action to overturning Citizens United?
Well, I think the most likely route to overturning Citizens United is if Justice Kennedy or one of the conservatives to his right leaves the court and President Obama has a chance to replace one of those five justices. I think that it wouldn't be long before there'd be another challenge before the court, and I think they would quickly move to reverse Citizens United because I think the four dissenters thought it was such a misinterpretation of the First Amendment, and it in itself had thrown out previous court precedents that I don't think they would like the whole respect for precedent, stare decisis thing stand in their way. Of course, that's all dependent upon does Kennedy or Scalia or some other conservative, Kennedy and Scalia are 74, do they leave during the presidency of President Obama?
Much more likely to be a liberal justice, I would think, at this stage of the game.
The oldest is Justice Ginsburg at 79. I think she'd be more likely to leave. That would not change the breakdown in Citizens United.
Right. Tom?
Well, I think what's interesting, you know, you reap what you sow, and I think it's kind of interesting because, first off, I agree. I think Citizens United, I mean, other than the fact that Bush versus Gore was such a, you know, such a result-oriented decision and bastardized in many respects everything that we talk about as lawyers with stare decisis and the rule of law. But Citizens United, at least in my judgment, is the worst decision I've ever seen since Plessy versus Ferguson. I just think it is absolutely awful. But what I think is interesting is this, that certain Republicans have started to feel the brunt of Citizens United, including the chairman of the House governmental committee. I was reading something this weekend. He got himself good and whacked by a lot of negative advertising. So maybe one of the ways that you can dilute the effects of Citizens United without running askance of the constitutional mandate laid down by the court is to make it more transparent. And don't allow people to go hide behind these 504Cs.
Remind our audience what the Plessy versus Ferguson case was all about, because many people don't understand.
That was the one that was the one that said that segregation is legal.
All right.
Think what Tom said about transparency is exactly right, because I think you've got these real constitutional problems, because even though I don't like the idea that a rich guy gets to spend as much money as he wants trying to convince people, you know, I don't know how you work around that. But I do think having it be transparent. And right now we have these things called 501c4s, which are – I think they're called social welfare groups. It's an IRS code. And basically, as long as you're not coordinating with the campaign, you can do all this stuff and hide who the donors are. And I think there are also ways that the 501c4 can then donate to other things. And – I think as long as voters can see, and with the internet, you know, make it transparent in almost real time, then because we saw this happen in Minnesota, Target made some contributions to a gubernatorial candidate because he was kind of pro-business. He also happened to be very kind of restrictive on gay rights, and there was this huge backlash against Target saying you shouldn't be giving money to this guy. And I think a lot of businesses, you know, ultimately it comes down to business for them, and they're going to do what's best for their business. And I think there's some costs associated besides giving all this money. there's the bad press that comes out of it.
And it's worth noting that Citizens United itself said that disclosure would be constitutional, most likely.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so
they almost assume there would be
right,
disclosure.
It's not Citizens United's fault that there's no disclosure. It's the Republicans blocked disclosure in the Congress.
They have. And the question is going to be now politically, has the shoe gone on the other foot? Mm-hmm. And now they've decided, well, this doesn't feel so good. And so perhaps we'll get that legislation.
Yeah, that's basically why I raised the question, because it was so ineffective. Before we get too far away from one of the subjects we've already discussed, I want to bring Lawrence from Baden into the conversation. He wants to us to backtrack just a little bit. So let's do that now, and then we'll move on. Lawrence, go ahead.
Back to Roe versus Wade. Yeah, since Ronald Reagan, I do believe there are cynical Republicans who have used this as an issue, and their constituency will always be there on it. But let's not kid ourselves, gentlemen. If Mr. Romney had won, he would be appointing justices that could tip. You know, Roe could have gone down in a Romney court at some point, and then it would go back to the states, and the constituency would have finally been rewarded, shall we say. But sooner or later, and I'm glad it didn't happen, I'm so glad that Barack Obama won, but a Romney court would have thrown it. We can only assume. And here's my cynicism for the day. I just hope that Barack Obama can get as liberal of a justice in as some past presidents got their conservatives in. Clarence Thomas, anyone? thank you very much, and a good holiday season to one and all.
Lawrence, thank you very much for the call.
I actually agree with much of what the caller said. I do think actually the biggest effect of the current election, of the recent election on the Supreme Court, was that Romney was not elected, because I think had he been elected, he would have had a good chance of replacing Justice Ginsburg, and that would have tipped the court even to an even more conservative court. That would have had a possible effect on Roe versus Wade, on religious freedom, separation of church and state, and a whole number of other issues. So I think that's correct. I think President Obama has been very effective in getting quite liberal justices on the court. In fact, his appointees to the court and previous Democratic appointees have voted in lockstep, just about in lockstep with what you would think would be moderate or liberal ideology, just as in most cases the Republican appointees have voted in lockstep conservatively, with the exception maybe of Justice Kennedy.
But the filibuster always looms in that chamber, even with Obama just starting a second term. I mean, there are some arrows that Republicans have in their quiver to block someone very liberal.
Well, except that, of course, right now we're starting to hear discussion with Harry Reid and whether or not we're going to start to reform filibuster. And of course, you know, people say that's a dangerous path. It just depends who's in the majority as to how dangerous you think it is at a particular point in the timeline.
People are the senators are very reluctant to filibuster a Supreme Court.
That one's always been off limits.
Yeah. Okay, let's go back to the telephone here and bring Gary into the conversation. He wants to talk about something we've discussed more recently. Go ahead, Gary.
Yes, I just had a question. I wonder if a roundabout way of attacking the Citizens United decision could be done by going after corporations legally, since the court determined they were individuals and had the rights of individuals. Could they lose their protections as corporations and be sued as an individual is sued?
Well, corporations sometimes are. I mean, they're even prosecuted for criminal violations.
Yeah.
And, you know, it wasn't really I'd have to go back to double check this, but I don't believe it was a holding of Citizens United that corporations are people. But I think that's maybe a little bit misleading. But corporations in many instances are treated like have legal consequences of people. They certainly, as Justice Stevens in dissent, though, pointed out, they certainly can't run for office. So, you know, why should we equate them with individuals in the political context?
Well, let's just be real honest about Citizens United. I mean, Citizens United allows corporations to give money.
Right.
And I don't get to know. So I might have stock in a corporation, and that corporation is funding political causes that I find abhorrent. And I don't get to know about it. And on top of that is that there's no disclosure. And on top of that, that's my money. So they're using my money in order to fund those types of and the converse can be true. I mean, I'm sure that there might even be a corporation in the world that actually funds a liberal cause. I don't know which one it is. I haven't found it yet. But there could be one. And so there could be Republicans who could feel like, you know, that it's important to them. So I really hate that decision.
You know, I heard a wonderful line the other night, and I hope no one is offended by this, but someone said
because I'm the master of offensive lines, but go ahead.
Someone said at a gathering that I'll believe that corporations are people when one comes in for a colonoscopy.
I'm not offended by that.
All right.
They give a lot of us colonoscopies, so the turnabout is fair play.
All right, let's move on to something else. We've been reading over the last couple of weeks about George Allen, a man who was accused of rape and murder some 30 years ago. And he is no longer in the custody of the state, thanks to the Innocence Project and Brian Cave.
Right.
Basically, he was released because it was alleged that the police withheld evidence and influenced a confession by Mr. Allen in connection with his crime. Prosecuting attorney Jennifer Joyce has decided that she will not retry the case. But Rich Koster, the attorney general, is appealing it.
Chris Koster, you mean.
What did I say?
You said Rich.
Rich Koster, well, his father.
Yeah, yeah.
Whom we all knew, I think. Right.
Maybe Chris, would like to Chris change Koster. His name to Rich after this decision to appeal it.
Well, what do you think about that? I mean, why would he do that when everything seems so weighted in favor of Mr. Allen's innocence? Thoughts, Tom?
I don't have any thoughts. I think you'd have to ask Mr. Koster. I mean, I find it so ridiculous. I mean, I know what you're going to say. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, Attorney General Koster has certainly styled himself in his election campaigns as being a tough on crime prosecutor, a guy who's appeared before juries. And so it's consistent with that. I agree with the dean, however, that I think it's not a good decision.
Well, it's purely a political decision. I mean, there's just no question about it. I mean, I salute Joyce Hayes. I mean, you know, God bless
Jennifer
her for
Joyce.
That.
All right, Jennifer, getting the names wrong.
Jennifer Joyce. All right, we're getting all the names wrong. You know who I mean. But I really salute her for doing that. I mean, it takes a lot of courage to do that.
But even Jennifer Joyce, and I'm a big fan of Jennifer Joyce, she made a point of saying, look, this decision does not say that Mr. Allen is innocent, that there are many people that believe he's guilty. So, you know, when you're a prosecutor, you got to look like a prosecutor, I think, and you got to be tough on crime. I'm not saying what Koster did is right. And Joyce, I think, made exactly the right decision by saying, I'm not going any further with it.
But it's not a question of what – he doesn't have to prove his innocence. They
right,
have to
right,
prove
right.
his
no,
guilt.
That's
a,
you're exactly
and she's
right.
made a decision that she cannot – you know, a lot of people, the really great prosecutors understand something very important. Their job is not to convict.
Right.
Their job is to do justice.
Justice, right.
You know, I thought Barry Schenck, you know, the fellow from the Innocence Project, had a pretty interesting statement to make that what really the Attorney General should be doing is looking at the whether or not this is part of sort of a pattern of misconduct by the St. Louis Police Department and their serologist, if that's how you pronounce that word, the person who tested the blood. Because, I mean, this fellow, Allen.
Yeah, but this happened in 82 or something, didn't it? Yeah. It was
it's not the only case where
there's a lot of people.
innocent people have been found.
I was going to say,
if
it happened in 82, then that makes it all the more important that you test it. I mean, this guy gave up 30 years of his life.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Apparently he was picked up because the police thought he was someone else. They were looking for a suspect. They got him. They thought he was the suspect. It turned out he wasn't the right person, but he gave a confession.
Well, on top of that, remember one other thing. He would have been put to death, but for the fact that – could have been put to death. He would have suffered a death sentence, but for the fact that one of the jurors had a personal decision.
You know, it's very disturbing on so many levels, not the least of which is there have been so many of these cases.
Yes, right.
Recently, and Brian Cave has gotten a lot of attention for some of the cases it's become involved in and some of the people who have been released as a result of the Innocence Project. Does anybody have a number of how many people they've caused to go free after investigation?
Probably not enough. That's the only thing I would say. say. Probably not enough.
But I think we're in the – I think we're definitely over 100, you know, 130, 150. I haven't seen that number lately, but it just keeps increasing.
Well, no, and also remember this, is that, you know, remember that we talk about repercussion. You talk about we talk about Citizens United and judges and accountability of judges. Remember Justice Chief Justice Tuttle. He wrote a decision. He wrote a decision that freed a man. Back in what? Right after he went up on the Supreme Court, and then he had to face this nasty retention bit. Nasty. Mm-hmm. And there's, you know, there's repercussions to that, which segues back to what we talked about in terms of electing judges, is that the notion of paying money for any candidate, whether you talk about Citizens United and its effect or on judges or anything else, it isn't just how much money you're giving them, it's the fear factor. Mm-hmm. They're afraid that somebody's going to come after them with the money. And that has a stifling influence.
I think so, too.
Before we take our next
– Well, I was just
going to
say one nice thing, and I'm glad you said it. You know, Brain Cave, I used to work there a long time ago.
And they miss you. They miss you.
I'm sure they do. I'm amazed they've kept going this long.
We are, too. But Marshall's doing well.
They're donating their lawyer's time and their money to do this kind of stuff. They're not a criminal defense firm. They're a big corporate white-collar not white-collar, but white-shoe law firm, and they're doing the right thing here, and that's a really nice thing, and I'm glad you gave them some recognition.
This is all pro bono work.
It is pro bono work. Yeah. We have a giant justice gap in this country.
This also shows that a newspaper person can have a second life. Tim O'Connell is the Brian Cave lawyer who was involved in this, a former Post-Dispatch copy editor and editorial writer. Yeah.
Okay, well, good. And we got the Cave, and we got the Post.
We got them all.
Right now. That's good.
Nothing for SLU, though.
we could use some help with SLU. Right?
Well, we want to talk about that in a moment, too. I have to take another break. Are all law firms required to do pro bono work at some level?
Yeah, they're not required. In the state of Illinois, I can talk about this. Is that, you know, we do pro bono work. It is not a requirement.
It's an expectation. And in federal court in Eastern District of Missouri, they'd give you appointed cases, and you would have to do those. I remember doing a couple of those.
If you're admitted to the bar. It's a condition admitted to the bar. But I think that people need to do more. There's a giant justice gap in this country, Don. Yeah. Just giant.
I know that's something you want to talk about, and we'll do that when we come back. We have to take another break in our legal roundtable discussion. With me in studio, our regulars Mark Smith and Bill Freivogel, and also joining us today is Dean Tom Keefe, the interim dean of the St. Louis University School of Law, from whom you just heard. Back in just a moment to continue our conversation. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our legal roundtable discussion. Our crack producers have come up with a figure, by the way, with regard to the Innocence Project and the number of people who have been freed as a result of their work through the year 2010. 301 people have been released as a result of the Innocence Project, and that doesn't take into account some of the other pro bono operations that we have talked about. Tom Keefe, let me come back to you. You brought up the subject, so we can talk about this for a moment or two, and that is the discord at St. Louis University really prohibits you in many areas from talking about some specifics about what's going on. But I'm wondering if you are sensing that this is having an impact on, one, the student body, number one, and number two, if it's having any impact on potential law school students.
Well, I think there's this little voice in the back of my head, and it's saying, now, be careful, Tom, what you say here.
Don't listen to that voice.
Don't listen to that voice. Let it rip. I like the Missouri Law Weekly interview I did. That one was good, too. I think a couple of things. Number one, you are correct, Don. Because I have a position on the Board of Trustees, and I am, by training, a lawyer, I believe that people have to listen to all of the evidence. And so I haven't heard all the evidence. I presume that this will be a topic for discussion when we meet on December the 15th. Number two, I think that certainly any time you have discord, it has a potential to be healthy. I mean, it's not something that you necessarily want every day. It's certainly not something that you want at a university all of the time. But, of course, I mean, you know, people need to express themselves, and I think that they need to have the ability to express themselves. But here's what I think, you know, when you talk to me about the law school, I really want to make this point about the law school. Because, you know, when I took the job at the law school, I certainly didn't anticipate the pushback that I would get taking the job. Some people actually thought I, you know, gave money to get the job. And as I pointed out, as I was going to give money, I'd rather be the ambassador to Barbados as that job. But the reality is that with respect to this law school, I mean, is that, you know, and I fold this in with the Jesuit mission. We're moving that law school downtown. We're moving 1,000 people into the city of St. Louis. And when you talk about students, faculty, and staff, and this is going to be a spectacular opportunity for these young people, these students, to actually get to go to school, you know, where the lawyer's lawyer and the judge's judge, and, you know, the Board of Aldermen makes laws, and the EOC does labor law, and the appellate courts hear their cases. You know, that was a decision that was made by the administration. I mean, so when we talk about all of these dark hearts, is that I'm just curious, you know, is that, you know, you're taking a school, you're moving it into the city of St. Louis, and you're bringing 1,000 people into the city. And the crown jewel that I found in my experience with this law school, other than the fact that the faculty is, you know, they're wonderful people and they're so dedicated, but it's the clinics. And we have this justice gap in this country. And our clinics at St. Louis University, I'm so proud of them. And what we're going to be able to do with this law school downtown is really enhance the clinics, which is the ability of those people to provide legal services to all of those disaffected individuals as a result of the fallout from this recession. Stop and think about this. We got people walking around with mortgages. And we talked, you know, that was one of our topics today, mortgage mediation. You got people walking around with credit card debt. You have people who live in a recession, and as a result of that is that there's tremendous stress at home, and so you have domestic violence victims. Honor our veterans. I mean, we have hundreds of homeless veterans just literally in the shadow of the arch. Those people don't have any access to justice. And our move downtown is going to enhance their access to justice through our clinics. So, you know, if everything is so bad over at the universities, at least the administration made that decision to move downtown. That tells me something about the Jesuit mission.
But you have indicated in conversations off mic that maybe we were bringing in too many law students these days, that it's, I think you used the word immoral.
I believe, and I truly do believe this, is that we don't have too many lawyers. We have too many lawyers with too much debt. And I think that is terrible. I think it is immoral. I mean, I think that, see, if a kid gets into law school, I mean, then at that stage of the game, if they don't have the money, they just get a loan. They get a federal loan. And then at that point, of course, the bankers are a much stronger lobby than the kids, and so that loan is never dischargeable in bankruptcy. But if we're only going to get, you know, one out of two or even two out of three kids a job, much less a job that will allow them to service that debt, that's unfair. And here's what the sad thing is. We have a gigantic justice gap in this country. If we took care of our people with legal problems the same way we took care of people with medical problems, stop and think about this. At least if you don't have health insurance, you can go to an emergency room, right? Mm-hmm. And there'll actually be a doctor who'll take care of you. If you have a legal problem, they say, well, the courts are open. Well, good. Then why don't you do the same thing as sending them to an emergency room? Say, here, help yourself to the emergency room. How do I run the x-ray machine? You know, how do I draw my blood? How do I do any of these things? We'd have people dead in the streets if we treated people medically the way we treat them legally. There's a gigantic justice gap. And so I think that the real challenge for legal education in the future is to try to find a way to fund tuition forgiveness programs and at the same time allow kids to then do public service law and help fill this justice gap in exchange for tuition forgiveness programs. That's where I think at that stage of the game, legal education can regain the high ground.
Mark, you're a career counselor at Washington yeah. University. What do you think about what you've just heard, and what do you advise young people who are talking about law school?
Oh, I do pre-law advising every day. So I always tell them this is a very serious decision. You need to think about it. You're going to spend a lot of time and money to go to law school, and you got to think about this debt you're taking on, and that you need to ask very pointed questions of the law school that you're going to about placement and things like that. The problem is, you know, I worked at a law school before, and you get these kids coming in, and they want to go to law school, and they're begging you to let you and they're convinced this is what they're going to do. I do think the trend and maybe the possible solution is some kind of loan repayment that is a percentage of your salary. And that's, I think, where we're probably going with it, not just for law schools, but maybe for higher education. I was at a conference where some people were talking about that. But there's going to be costs associated with that, and I'm not sure everyone's going to want to pick those up. But these kids coming out with $150,000 of debt, making maybe $40,000 at a lower paid job, there's just, you know, it's, you got a house mortgage, no house, and the prospects for paying that off are not very, very promising.
I heard an interview on NPR a couple of weeks ago with a woman, a young attorney, who was a public defender. I mentioned my son is a public defender in this program. That's not relevant to this particular conversation.
Well, it is to me. I like him already, for heaven's sake.
But my son is too. they're both destined to be poor for the rest of their lives. We all know that. But this woman was saying she came out of a college with enough debt so that effectively it would be paid off on her 65th birthday. That's how serious it is.
That's exactly how serious it is. And stop and think about this, is that you talk about where's the money going to come from. You know, I mean, what about this notion of giving these kids federal funds? If the kid is, you said, Mark, people want to go to law school. So then that's their dream. Well, that's good. They're making a decision at 22 years old, and they don't have any idea what the implications of that decision are for the rest of their life. Now, we talked about, you know, the Republicans would say that and I don't want to sound too partisan. Yes, I do. but people would say that people who signed on for these loans, for federal mortgages, when they bought houses that they couldn't afford, they should have known better. Well, so then what are we to tell these kids? They should have known better. They have this dream of going to law school, and they should have known better. Or they should know that when they go in, they're going to be the one of two people who are not going to find that good job. And the reality is the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. Because if you're at the top of your class, we're going to give you a scholarship because we want to get our higher students in, right? And then at that point, if you then graduate high in your class, you're going to get the job at Bryan Cave, which pays a lot of money. So I mean, it's a vicious circle. How do I break the circle? Here's what my idea is. Is that with the federal loan program, is that let's be more selective with the loan money that we're going to give out. And on top of that, let's use some of those federal loan savings to fund tuition forgiveness programs, which in turn can fold into and address what I call this justice gap.
Right. Bill, do you want to weigh in on this?
I will only say that I just this month paid off my law school loan. So, but the whole Father Biondi issue at St. Louis U, it seems to me, from my point of view, it's the clash of two things that I thought were universal truths. One is that no one takes on Father Biondi and wins. and the other universal truth is that nobody takes on tenure at a university and wins.
Right.
So we'll see which of those wins out.
All right. And for the record, the trustees are going to be meeting in the middle of December.
They are. I think December the 15th.
Yep.
December the 15th. Be there or be square.
All right. Well, I'm certain it will be covered and that we'll be reading about what goes on. Back to a couple of other issues I'd like to get to, unless anyone wants to add to what we've just been talking about here. One of the things I have in my notes here is how well-versed are you gentlemen on maritime law?
I am.
Are you?
Well, heck yeah.
I would suspect.
It's personal injury, for heaven's sake. If people get hurt, I know about it. That's how I get paid.
Well, this is a case that, you might be involved with one day. Who knows? A carpenter working from a barge in downtown St. Louis fell from the barge and died, I believe. The suit was filed, but it was the employers who filed the suit, basically limiting any damages to the value of the barge. Tom, okay, I'll throw this one to you. Most people, I suspect, and I'm one of them, figure, what's going on here?
Well, in the first place, is that what happened was is that the lawyers at Fox and Yalvin, who are very good lawyers, is that they beat Maurice Graham to the courthouse. And essentially what happened was—
This is inside stuff, by the way. Okay, we don't know who these folks are.
All right, well, I'm telling you, but Maurice Graham represents a plaintiff. Mm-hmm. Right? He's a great plaintiff's lawyer. And Fox and Galvin represent the barge company, or in this case, the contractor. Now, there's an old provision of maritime law. As a matter of fact, the statute was passed in 1851. It's called the Shipowners Act. And it provides that if you are injured and if you are unable to establish that there was any negligence on the part of the ship owner or that the vessel was otherwise seaworthy and so on and so forth, then you can beat the plaintiff to the federal court, pick the court, which in this instance would have been the federal court. I'm sure Mr. Graham would have preferred to have been in state court. And then at that point, ask that the court limit your liability to the value of the vessel. And in this instance, the value of those vessels were the barges upon which this lifting device were perched. And the total value of those vessels is $251,000. And so that's what's called a limitation. So it's called exoneration or limitation. Exoneration almost never occurs. That's when you go in and say, we didn't do anything wrong, and the federal court just lets you off the hook. Limitation can occur if you can meet those three conditions.
And if Attorney Maurice Grant had beat them to the courthouse and went into state court, the other guys couldn't have removed it to federal court, saying
it doesn't
federal
matter.
Law controls?
Yeah, they would have still been able to file in federal court and then removed him.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. The question is going to be whether or not the federal case will survive a motion to dismiss or a motion for summary judgment.
So this is kind of – we've talked about preemption before. It's basically this federal law preempting the state law claim for negligence, right?
It's interesting. In a way, that's true. And what's interesting about that is, of course, preemption has become a recent problem. And this statute, of course, was passed over 170 years ago.
Right.
It was passed in 1851 because back in those days, being a ship owner, had real significant implications. Maritime law as a body of law was a very significant area of law then.
I noticed that that Mr. Graham pointed out that, I guess, OSHA at one point had recommended fines in this particular construction project of the Mississippi River Bridge for the very kind of situation that led to this accident, for having a moving boom, a boom like this on a moving movable vessel.
Well, and that was despite the manufacturer's recommendations.
Recommendations against, right.
The bottom line is, what do I think is going to happen? I think that the case is going to be dismissed, and I think that the plaintiff's going to get or the plaintiff's family is going to get their day in court, because they're going to be able to show in this instance, I believe, sufficiently that there was negligence. Also, remember this: the federal courts are reluctant to impose exoneration and certainly limitation on cases if you can show some negligence, and particularly when there's severe personal injury, in this instance, death.
Okay. Time is starting to get away from us here. I wanted to bring one other subject up. Several, but we'll only have time for one more, I think, and that is holiday displays. It is the holiday season, after all. What do communities and individuals need to know, Bill Freivogel, about holiday displays so they don't get into any trouble this year?
Well, there has been people talk about the need to, if you're a municipality and you want to have a nativity scene, a creche, that then it is to make sure that you're dotting your constitutional I's and crossing the T's, it should be part of a holiday display.
You got to throw in a snowman.
Throw in a snowman right. Or a reindeer or Santa Claus, Christmas tree. Christmas tree is considered to be a secular a non-religious symbol. So you can't, for example, the court decided in a case involving the Allegheny County Courthouse in Pittsburgh, you can't have a creche on the main staircase of a courthouse standing all by itself, that is a violation of the separation of church and state. Now, that's the kind of case that had the election come out differently and had Ginsburg been replaced by a Romney appointee, it could have ended up changing that whole concept of law.
Any do you have something, Tom?
I don't. Okay. I know. This comes up every year.
Yeah.
I mean, the First Amendment. It says that we are not allowed to pass any laws that affect the establishment of religion or affect the free exercise thereof. And so this is just a perennial thing.
What about private individuals? Are there any kind of restrictions against them,
Well,
Mark?
There, if I'm a private individual, I mean, I can put whatever I want on my front lawn. That's fine. But if I put it on public land, then the big thing is just the government that lets me put it on the public land can't say, okay, Mark, you can put your creche up, but Bill, you can't put your menorah up. So they have to be open to everyone.
But you have a constitutional right to put your menorah on your or any kind of religious symbol on your front lawn, or a church to put it on their on their front lawn. There's a case just from last week out in Santa Monica, where Santa Monica decided that they had a Palisades Park where they allowed – there had been for many years a creche that had been displayed. And then there were complaints from atheists, and Santa Monica decided, well, we're not going to have any kind of displays in that park, which is something they probably – a judge said they could do.
Well, we're going to have to leave it at that. This has been a very fast hour and covered a lot of turf, but we'll have to save some of it for next time. I want to thank you all so much for being with us. Tom Keefe, good to see you. Thank you so much for being
a slice
a part
of heaven.
Of
I enjoyed it. Thanks a lot.
Slice of heaven. That's exactly the way we describe it every week. Bill, a slice of something. We can debate what it's a slice of. Bill Freivoger, thank you for being with us. I guess next time we talk will be probably prior to the Christmas holiday,
yeah.
But hopefully we'll get to do that before Christmas. Mark,
maybe
Smith,
we'll have some religious displays, people getting sued about them. We can talk about it again.
There's always that potential. Thank you, Mark Smith, Tom Keefe, and Bill Freivoger.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about Ralph Carson's research on brain health and its connection to eating disorders. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.